Hi, good morning. How are you today? I hope you're having a good week. Today I want to talk to you about football, soccer. Before that though, don't forget, as always, if you click on the link in the description below here, you can find the script for this talk, you can find questions and you can find answers. You can practice your listening, your reading, your writing, and your speaking if you do the answers out loud. Okay, today, football, soccer. Where does football come from? Well, ball sports are very, very natural. Humans kick naturally, and there are many, many round objects in the world. It's natural for us to kick round objects. So it's quite natural that ball sports would develop. China had a sport called Kudzu from about 250 BC. Kudzu basically means kick ball. Japan had one as well, Kemari, which again was a ball sport. Greece had Episkyros in 250 AD, and Rome, of course, had a game called Harpistum. These were all played with an inflated sheep or pig's bladder. Basically, you would take the bladder from the animal, you would fill it with air, and you would seal it up, and it holds the air pretty well, of course. The difference, I suppose, in Asia, these games were mostly ceremonial, whereas in Greece and Rome, there was a large amount of violence in the games as well. They were probably more like today's rugby than football. But still, ball sports are very natural. So, as we go through history, as ball sports spread out across the world, and they came into Central Europe and up, of course, into England, where I'm from. And from about 800-900 AD, we have basically mob football. Now, this again uses an inflated pig's bladder, but the difference here is that rather than having a few players on each side and a goal at each end, you basically have two towns or two villages against each other. You have hundreds of people on each side, and these games can last an entire day. Basically, the ball starts in the middle, and each team uses whatever methods they want to get the ball to the other end's goal. They're basically part of a celebration, part of a festival. And there are no real rules. Anything short of murder is allowed. Occasionally, people have been killed in these games, but hopefully not so much these days. These games are still played. Some places in England still have an annual town versus town football match, which can be quite interesting to watch. I don't know if I'd recommend taking part in it, but anyway. So, we have a game of football. It's very, very different to modern football, of course. And that game continues until 1835. In 1835, England decided to standardize its roads. And to do that, they brought out the Highway Act of 1835. They basically brought out a list of rules that you had to follow for every road. And one of those rules, of course, was no ball sports to be played on a public highway. If you have private roads, that's fine, but if you're playing on a public road, you cannot play. So these mob football games came to an end. They couldn't play anymore. Plus, also at that time, from about the 1770 onwards, after the Industrial Revolution, basically the working people who live in the cities, they don't have time to keep playing. They're working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. Even the children are working, so there's no time for them to play or take up a game like football. So, how does football go from being a mob rules game played by poor people to the game it is today? Well, of course, it was taken up by wealthy people. From about 1500 onwards, many of the public schools in England started to play organized ball sports games similar to modern football. In the 1500s, there weren't that many public schools, but as we go through the next 200-300 years, and as you get more and more wealthy people, you have more and more public schools. And as we get more and more public schools, we get more and more different types of football. We'll talk about that in a second. There is some evidence that football was being played in the 1500s. William Horman, the headmaster of Eton Public School at the time, in 1519, he actually wrote a Latin textbook for his students. And one of the sentences he had the students translate from Latin into English was, "We will play with a ball full of wind," which is pretty much the first reference we have to football in England. So, as we go into the 1800s, we have more and more and more public schools, and each one of these schools is playing their own version of football. And that's fine. As long as they keep within the school, there's no real problem there. Of course, in the 1840s, the rail network in Britain starts to be developed. We have trains that now run between the major industrial centres of England. Now, because we have these trains, the people from these public schools can now travel to other public schools and we can have inter-school competitions. That sounds like a great idea, unless, of course, you consider that each school is playing by their own set of rules. When you have two schools meeting, how do they play a game? They have to spend the first few hours deciding which set of rules to follow. So should we take some of your rules and some of our rules and mix them? What should we do? So, of course, having no standardized form of football does start to present problems. So, people sit down and they think, okay, we've got to have some kind of rule system. So in 1848, Cambridge University, a few people sit down and they make the Cambridge Rules. Now, these rules have some properties that we still use today, but also quite a lot of differences. One of the major ones being, of course, that you could carry the ball with your hands, and also that you could tackle players. You could sweep their feet out from under them, which, of course, you're not allowed to do today. 1848, the Cambridge Rules, they were not taken up by many schools, so we still have the same problem continuing. 1863, Ebenezer Cobb-Morley. He is known as the father of modern football. He's known as that for a good reason. He basically founded the FA, the Football Association. He sat down in his house and he said to himself, we have all these schools playing football. We need a proper standardized set of rules. So he made them. He wrote down his laws of the game. That's why he's known as the father of modern football. Incidentally, I said at the beginning of this talk I was going to talk about football, and then I paraphrased it, soccer. Why is that? Well, in America, of course, people call this game soccer, and in England, we call it football. And we always say to Americans, this game is called football. You play it with your feet. It's not called soccer. But I found out researching this talk that the word soccer didn't come from America. It actually comes from England. In the beginning with the FA, well, what does FA stand for? Football Association. The game was called Association Football. Now, British people are very lazy. We like to shorten words. For example, rugby is quite often shortened to rugger. Association, what would you shorten that to? Sock. Sock's hard to say. Soccer rolls off the tongue much more easily. So in the 1860s, 1870s, this game was called soccer. And then, of course, the word soccer went across to America with the game, and they kept it. However, in England, after the Second World War, we decided that the word soccer was too Americanized. Of course, in America, they have their own game of football, American football. They kept soccer to refer to football, and they used football to refer to American football. So we decided the word soccer was too Americanized, so we stopped using it. So after the Second World War, we reverted from soccer to football. So now most people, when they meet an American and they say, no, the game's called football, you play it with your feet, they should think that actually, originally, in England, we called the game soccer. So Americans are not at fault there. In fact, Americans are staying truer to the tradition of the sport. So, Ebenezer Cobb-Morley, he comes up with the FA rules. He comes up with his code of conduct. Now, you need more than one person, you need more than one school to take up these rules, of course. So, on the 23rd of October, 1863, in the Freemasons Tavern, Covent Garden, which is in London, we had the very first FA meeting. About six of the main teams came together for that meeting. And in that meeting, they decided which rules to stick with. However, the first point of contention came up with some people wanted to stick with the Cambridge rules, and some people wanted to use the new FA rules. Now, the Cambridge rules, remember, meant you could carry the ball and while you run, and they also meant you could tackle. The people that liked the Cambridge rules, they had a split with the other group of teams, and they went off on their own. And they actually formed Rugby Union. So today we have the games rugby and soccer, but they have the same root. They come from the same place. They split in 1863 when rugby players went off wanting to carry the ball and tackle and be violent, which they do. And soccer players wanted to be more elegant, I suppose. So 1863, we have the FA Cup rules. So in the 1860s, we start to get a growth in teams. We have, of course, all the public school teams. But we also start to get some non-public school teams developing. However, there are no professional players. Until 1885, there are only amateur players. In fact, the FA actually banned any professional players from playing the game. Now, of course, that meant that no working class people could play. Only wealthy people could play, because if you were working class, you had to work. You didn't have time to play football. However, in 1885, they finally loosened that rule and they allowed professional players. That meant a team could pay its players, which meant that working class people could now play soccer. However, they stipulated that all these players must have lived within 10 kilometers of the home team's ground for within 2 years. So they were quite strict. Unlike today, where we have players from all over the world and whoever can pay the most gets the best players. So the 1860s, we get more teams. 1867, we have the very first soccer competition. It's called the Yode Cup, and it comes from Sheffield. And then 1872, we have the first FA Cup. Now, this was instrumental in bringing together all of the soccer teams and introducing the FA Cup rules, because the FA Cup was very, very popular. However, if you wanted to join in the FA Cup, if you wanted to take part, you had to abide by their rules. So thanks to the FA Cup, all these teams came together and they started to take on the FA Cup rules. And once the majority began to follow them, it snowballed. We had a tipping point and then more and more teams took it up until the FA rules governed the entire soccer body. In 1888, the first league was developed. In 1895, the first women's match was played. In 1933, we have the first World Cup. And of course, now we have soccer as you see it today. There have been a few changes since the original rules. A few things have been modernized and adapted and cut. Players have changed as well, of course. The uniforms have changed. The level of pay, of salary, has also changed as well. These days, soccer players are basically superstars. Okay, so two more points with soccer, I suppose. The first one is wealth. I just touched on that. These days, soccer players are paid very large sums of money. Ronaldo, probably the world's most famous soccer player, is currently worth about $350 million. Some people would argue he doesn't deserve it. Some people would argue he does. That's entirely your opinion. I'm not going to talk about that. However, one of the things about soccer is that a lot of people living in poor areas, a lot of children living in slums, living in poverty, they see soccer as a way out of the slums. They see that if they become very good at soccer and they get picked up by a talent scout, they can find a way to fortune, to success. However, of course, the amount of soccer players that are actually chosen from those slums is a minuscule amount. It's 0.001%, I suppose. But it does give a dream to these poor people, as it did in England back in the early 19th century, when poor people became professional soccer players. They had a way out of poverty. So if you go to countries like Brazil, countries with a lot of poverty, you do see a lot of people playing soccer. It's also a very easy game to play. You don't need to buy much equipment. As long as you have a ball, you can basically play soccer. The second thing, we can't really talk about soccer without talking about hooliganism. Soccer hooliganism. I'm from England, which of course was famous for its hooligans. Not so much these days. Other countries have taken the mantle from us, but up until about 10, 15 years ago, England was very, very famous for its soccer hooligans. So why do we have hooliganism associated with soccer? Well, firstly, it's not because of the soccer. The soccer is the excuse for the hooligans. They're basically using this as an excuse to fight. There is no inherent thing in soccer that makes people want to fight. However, unlike other teams, and I'm not sure why this is, people invest much more of their sense of identity into their soccer team. If your team are doing well or if your team are losing, it affects you as a person. You don't see people supporting cricket or people supporting rugby being that invested in their team. Maybe they are, I don't know. But with soccer, it becomes almost as though your team is your country. And to defend your country, to be patriotic, to defend your country, to defend your team is almost the same thing. So when two teams come together, it's not the same as two sports teams coming together. It's almost as though two countries are coming together. It's a very interesting condition. Of course, most of the hooligans are men. I have never ever heard of women being hooligans. I mean, it may happen, probably does happen. But because it's basically ritualized male violence, you only really get men committing these acts of hooliganism. And something that came out in the 1980s, 1990s was that these groups of hooligans were actually being organized. They had central committees. They had organization, almost like a paramilitary organization. They would target matches, they would target groups, they would meet at certain times, they would go there with the intention of fighting, not for the soccer, not for the match, they would go there with the intention of fighting the opposing team, and the opposing team would do the same. So the actual match, the soccer match, becomes second place. It becomes unimportant. It's just a reason for these two armies to come together and fight each other. England, I became very embarrassed to be English during the 2000s or so, when this hooliganism was spreading across Europe. It became very, very embarrassing. But it's dying down, of course, these days. Why is that? Well, one reason is football is now more expensive. It's much more expensive to get a season ticket to go and watch a match. So your average person can't afford to go anymore. These hooligans have been targeted by the police. They've been given life bans. They've been given travel bans. Even before international matches, they have their passports confiscated or they're banned from traveling. And better policing. The police are much more on the ball. They're much more interested in the hooligans. They use face recognition software. They can target the hooligans before they even get to the match, which of course has reduced the amount of hooliganism. So that's basically soccer. I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you for watching. Don't forget, if you click the link below here, you can find the script for this. You can find some questions and you can find some answers. You can practice reading. You can practice writing. You can practice your listening. If you liked it, click like. If you want to subscribe, it's over here. Looks like my head. Thank you. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye.